Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt, slashing your taxes, and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, who has a vast collection of vintage DC and Marvel comic books, and ironically lives in Minnesota, where his favorite NBA team, the LA Lakers, originated, Dave Denniston.
And this podcast, my friends, isn't possible without having some generous sponsorship. I'd especially like to thank our latest sponsor, Plastic. That's Plastiq. Plastic. These people help to keep your business running smoothly. Make sure to check them out, plastiq.com/physicians. Again, that's Plastic with a Q.
Hello, my friends. This is Dave Denniston, and welcome back to another episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, a podcast dedicated to helping doctors like you slash your debt, slash your taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle. And of course, today we're talking about taxes. We all know how much we hate taxes, and today we're going to delve into some strategies and thoughts on how to reduce them, mistakes people make. Our next guest, she is not your typical accountant. She's an entrepreneur. She's a fearless single mom. She even has a background in military tactical training, so she's not your average CPA. And she loves talking about tax reduction. She's here with a team of people to help people get out of legal tax avoidance type strategies, or how to get into legal tax avoidance type strategies. Please help me welcome Shannon Stewart. Welcome, Shannon.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here today. Yeah, definitely. We're going to be talking about some cutting edge things. We're going to be talking about navigating the new tax environment. And we're also going to be talking about the fact that it's not business as usual. You know, there are definitely critical strategies for navigating this new age of, you know, forensic tax accounting that we find ourselves in, especially underneath the new tax law. So I hope to kind of differentiate today of, you know, what's critically changed, what are those strategies, what's the difference between a tax strategist and a tax preparer, and help individuals become a little bit more educated on how they can legally mitigate their tax situation.
Love it. That sounds good to me. So, Shannon, before we get into that, I'd just love to know more about your background. I mentioned that you are a serial entrepreneur. You've done this military stuff. I believe you began your career with GE. Give us a little bit of a background into you.
Yeah, so I started my career with GE, and I was one of two advisors that was actually trained to work with GE employees and their high net worth E-band employees. And so I did that for a number of years until I became a mom and I needed to move home. And it kind of simultaneously happened that GE decided to actually get out of the financial service business and divest themselves. And so I was with GE Capital, and they kind of spun off and became another company. And I saw that as my opportunity to actually get into my own business. And my mom was a retiring tax professional, and we just kind of merged our businesses and our practices together. And I went to all of those different GE clients I had and said, hey, I'm going to do this on my own. Will you follow me? And that was history. That was, you know, 20 years later, here we are. We are a firm that is based in several different states. We have a wonderful virtual team of tax professionals, CPAs, and enrolled agents that serve over 1,800 clients. But I also, you know, I also own several different businesses along with that. I have a company called Gunpowder and Lace. Then we do concealment garments and holsters for women. My father had a background in the Justice Department for 31 years, and so I was raised around firearms. I was tactically trained, and so that was just a really neat fit that continues to kind of run alongside what I already do.
That is really, really interesting. So if we break this down a little bit, you own a few businesses. I'd love to know, and maybe we can tap into the tax changes a little bit for this year. With the changes that have happened with taxes, are you thinking about your businesses differently? Like, I know for me, I have about four different businesses, and I'm considering for this year splitting my land flipping business off from the other three. because real estate looks like it's going to be treated even more favorably for coming years, at least for the foreseeable future.
You know, David, that is exactly right. You know, it's not accounting as usual anymore. It's not going to work that way. Entity selection is critical underneath this new tax environment. And so when I work with entrepreneurs, what we're actually looking for is we're looking at specifically what they're doing within their businesses. And so are they a service-based business or are they more of a product-based business? Because the new tax, you know, law change actually is making that differential and the different phase outs and so forth. You know, we want to make sure that we're maximizing those phase outs and actually splitting up the businesses so that we can maximize that qualified business income tax deduction becomes critical.
So let's talk about that a little bit, because you touched on it about the difference in service-based businesses, and we've talked about it in the podcast, but I think it's been a few months from the time this one has aired. So let's talk about that a little bit. So there's, if you are a sole proprietor or S-Corp, there's this 20% of your pass-through income that won't get taxed at all. Is that right?
Right. There's something now called the Qualified Business Income Deduction. It's the new 20% pass-through deduction. And it's going to be for anyone who is an LLC. So if they are a sole proprietor, they receive a 1099 income and they're filing a Schedule C on their tax return, or they're part of a multi-member partnership. So they're filing a Form 1065 and they're going to receive a K-1. Or they're an S-Corp, meaning that they get a W-2, but they also get that K-1. So all of those different entities are going to be able to qualify for either the full 20% deduction or a phased out deduction of 20% of their income.
So how do we know how that works yet? Because I know there's been a lot of questions about how that is going to work. Do you have any clarity yet in terms of?
So it's going to actually flow through on the personal tax return. So remember, whenever we have a company, let's say, for instance, we have an S-Corp. The S-Corp doesn't actually pay the taxation. All of the taxation from that corporation, from the S-Corporation, actually flows through to the shareholder through his W-2 and his K-1, then that calculation for the qualified business income deduction is actually going to be recorded on the personal tax return. And there's been some mock-ups of what that page 2 is going to look like and where that's going to fall from that standpoint.
So no clarity yet in terms of page 2.
There's not a whole lot. There's some great guests that are out there, but not anything, you know. I think we'll all be surprised when the IRS actually issues the form so we can take a look at all the schedules and worksheets that they're putting together from there.
And when is this? Is this like October or January? Like when should we expect to see this?
I would start to think that we would start to see some mock forms by the fall time period. But, you know, I've also seen, I've been in the business long enough where I've seen where we don't actually have forms until, you know, we get into January. I mean, this last tax season, literally, we were preparing tax returns and we were under the assumption that energy credits were no longer valid. So, you know, when they passed this new tax law, they forgot some of the different, you know, caveats that were in the code that kind of expired December 31st that we all assumed would be there, like energy credits, you know, for that new roof or that furnace. And so we started preparing tax returns, and we didn't even have the forms. So when they changed the law in January that they were going to allow energy credits, we didn't have the forms to be able to actually file to get those credits for individuals. We had to wait for those forms to be constructed and then all of our software companies to update the forms within their systems. So,
interesting. So the earliest is probably October because they're finishing with all the 2017 stuff. You know, we got past April, but now we have September for the corporate extension deadline and October for the individual. So, yeah, I could see this dragging on for a little while. So let's redirect a little bit to more about this. You mentioned earlier, I can't remember if it's when you and I were talking before we started or when we started the podcast, but you talked about the tax law having some forensic changes outside of the 20% and some of the tax brackets that are easy to see in terms of some of the changes. What do you mean by forensic tax law changes?
So One of the things that has been flying under the radar is that the IRS has really gone AI, or artificial intelligence. The days of taxes as usual are really over. You know, I've been talking about this on other podcasts and on my own site that starting as early as 2015, we started to see actually articles where the IRS was using computer scientists to actually battle tax evasion. And so there's an article in the New York Times, I think it was from 2015, where it actually talks about the federal authorities are actually using artificial intelligence and algorithms to look for abusive tax shelters and also to, you know, to actually kind of prevent tax evasion. You know, before, when we talked about what the IRS did, it was like looking for a needle in a haystack. You know, they were on a quest to look for a needle in a haystack because they were doing it individually. They were using, you know, archaic ways to do that. And now with the aid of computers, and, you know, there's, you know, over 75,000 pages of legal gray areas and credits and deductions and exemptions in the current code. Now utilizing computers, the accuracy that they can actually pinpoint discrepancies in tax returns and tax filings is phenomenal how accurate it is. And even just recently, this spring, I was actually on the IRS website, and it actually has on their website in their job section that they are looking for an artificial intelligence analyst to solve IRS business problems using networks, data mining, encryption, modeling, text generation. I mean, they're actually applying these artificial techniques and other advanced accounting skills to really, you know, get a handle on everything that's moving in our tax returns and in the financial markets. And so, you know, years ago, it would be very, I would have someone come to me that needed help. Maybe they got an IRS letter or state letter. And I would see that they filed a joint federal return, and they filed married filing separate state returns because the state government and the federal government were not linked together. It was a system that was very easily manipulated because oftentimes it's more advantageous to file married filing separate to get a bigger state refund, and it really depends on the state. But people would do that when they were filing their own taxes, and it would fly underneath the radar. Well, now the federal government and the state government are actually electronically connected, so it's not easy to manipulate. You have an electronic footprint that's now trackable by the IRS into the state. And so it's just the same kind of technology that we utilize when, let's say we're a business owner and we're marketing to people and we're using Google AdWords or Facebook Analytics to monitor and track our users' behavior. Well, that's the same type of technology now that is being actually used to monitor your taxable transactions. And I'll give you a couple of examples. I had a gentleman come to me, and I've been doing his taxes for about 9 years now. And I was going through the review process, and he was a remote client, and so I'm looking at all the tax documents he had loaded into the portal, and I see that he had a 1095 regarding health insurance. And so he had health insurance. He was covered. We have to report that on the tax return now. But the health insurance was actually underneath a female's name, and it said that he was the spouse. They had different last names. So I called the client and said, hey, I guess congratulations are in order. It seems that you're married now. And then it was dead silent on the phone. And I'm like, Mr. Client? He's like, no, I've been married for quite some time. Like, oh, well, and I'm going through my fact finders, you know, I'm a high fact finder. And so I'm going through all the fact finders. I said, gosh, we've been doing your taxes for quite some time. I didn't see where you were married, and I didn't see where, you know, you filed married filing separate for you last year. And he said, well, I'm not filing married filing separate because I'll lose credits and deductions, and there's a marriage, you know, tax penalty. And I go, ooh, wait a second. Then I can't file for you because by law you have to file married filing separate or married filing joint. And I said, unless there's certain circumstances, and we went into them, and I disqualified those circumstances. And he said, well, I'm not telling the federal government I'm married. I said, well, that's interesting, but here, so let's talk about this for a second. I'm looking at a tax document that's now in the IRS's possession, that you're on your wife's health insurance plan. Her Social Security number's on there, your Social Security number's on there, you're linked as being married. Do you not believe that the IRS will put two and two together? And it may take them 2 years because the system takes some time, but you're going to get a letter, and you're going to have penalties for evading taxes. Needless to say, after I explained to him that I was not going to be able to do his taxes because of this unless he walked within the letter of the law, we went back and fixed this return and fixed the subsequent year returns where he was actually married. But everything is linked now, and the IRS system is becoming more and more, it's a smart system, and they're hiring individuals to make it smarter and smarter. So the days of filing, you know, kind of flying under the radar, they don't exist any longer.
Hmm. So with that being said, you know, what are maybe one or two strategies? We don't have hours and hours and hours,
right.
But you know, what are two different strategies? Maybe we'll think of one for those of us that have W-2 jobs, and maybe mm-hmm. one for those of us that own our own practice, or maybe want to own our own practice one day.
Right.
Let's start with the W-2s. You know, what's one good strategy for them?
So for both categories of people, honesty is always the best policy, you know, from that standpoint. Making sure that your tax professional has a clear understanding of who you are and what your circumstances are so that they can file an error-free return for you. That's critical. And they help you to keep in compliance with the law. You know, one of the things I see with W-2s is that oftentimes we want to get as much money as we can during the year. And so we bump up those exemptions. So we might be mm-hmm. married with two kids, but we're really claiming four. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? That's something that the IRS is starting to crack down on as well. And if you get a letter from the IRS stating that we know you're claiming too many exemptions, they're going to send a letter to your employer as well, and they're going to mandate that you actually withhold at the highest rate with no exemptions. So just don't get yourself into that position as a W-2 employee.
Let me just dig into that a little bit, because I know that oftentimes, you know, in the past at least, we've gotten nice refunds, right? And so we don't want to be loaning Uncle Sam money, and we mm-hmm. play with the exemptions in order to get it more on par with what we're actually paying. So maybe we get a refund of $1,000 rather than $4,000 or $5,000. We still could do that, right? That's not an issue.
Playing with exemptions and claiming what you're legally able to are two different things. So, I mean, that's why the IRS actually gives you that little worksheet that goes along with the W-4. That just talks about, you know, if you have how many, you know, are you married, you get one. Do you have a spouse, you get, you know, do you have children? And really using that worksheet and not deviating from that worksheet. Now, you know, and I'm talking about these extreme cases where someone will claim, you know, claim 10 on their W-4, so they have no withholding at all. And then they run the risk of owing the government at the end of the year. These are the people that they're looking for, those people that are claiming very high exemptions, and they're owing sums of money at the end of the year when they're, you know, when they're legally responsible to actually only withhold their exemption amounts.
Right.
So I don't think it's going to be such a red flag for those individuals that are getting refunds. I'm talking more for those individuals who owe $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 every year because they're manipulating those exemptions.
Right. Okay, got it. Now, what about for business owners? What's a tax reduction tactic that you think might be good for them to think about for this year? Just one.
So if you're an S corp and your tax professional has not talked to you about an accountable plan, I think that's something that would be something that I would actually bring up to them. And do you know, have you heard of an accountable plan?
No, I have no idea what that is, to be honest.
Okay, so one of the things is that oftentimes when we are sole proprietors or we are in a, maybe it's even a multi-member partnership or we're in an S-Corp, and most of the time I'm talking to S-Corp owners when we're talking about this. So, you know, so there's a couple of things that happen when we're an S-Corp. So we might have a small business and we may not, let's say we're talking to a doctor and he actually goes from hospital to hospital, but he has a home office. So sure. he has an office in his home. So an accountable plan is simply a way that is a way that we can actually pick up some of those deductions that are being paid through personal means. So maybe it's a cell phone, it's a home office, it's mileage. It is a way that we can actually track and get the benefit from a tax standpoint of those things that we might be just paying out of our personal checking account. And those are the things that we should be technically reimbursing ourselves for through our business. So think of you and your business as separate entities. And oftentimes when we have an S-corp or we have a sole proprietor, they don't do that. You know, oftentimes I see where they're running all of their business and their personal income through one checking account. And so really, you have to have two separate business entities. And also, you have to have a means to reimburse yourself for those items that you're actually paying through that personal checking account. And you really need to do it in a formal way. And so an accountable plan and an accountable plan reimbursements help you do that, you know, in a way that's documented for the IRS. And it gives a methodology and a way of tracking those expenses so you're not kind of, you know, just making them up on the fly. You actually, you know, have a spreadsheet that's going to correlate to your income statement or a spreadsheet that correlates to the receipts that you have in your shoebox at the end of the year. And it's a way that you can actually take all of those expenses that you're mixing in with your personal right now and provide some detail around them and then be reimbursed either quarterly or annually, you know, before your memory fades. Oftentimes we're doing taxes, you know, if we're on extension, we're doing taxes, you know, 18 months later and memories fade. So by just making sure you have an accountable plan, you have a reimbursement template and you're, you know, kind of documenting everything, it becomes, and, you know.
Well, I'm sorry. I was going to say, is it specifically through a software like a Xero or QuickBooks or just on an Excel spreadsheet or?
Right. So we actually have a program that we actually utilize with our clients that we've kind of put together and branded, and we provide them with an app and a fancy, you know, spreadsheet where everything is categorized for them. And we, you know, when we're meeting on a quarterly basis, we're actually helping them fill out that reimbursement template and get that monies back over to them. And that brings us to the transition because not every tax professional is the same. So there's a difference between a tax strategist and, you know, a tax preparer, you know, like a CPA or an enrolled agent. You know, a CPA's job is to keep you in tax compliance, to file an error-free return, record your business history, and keep you in compliance with the law, which is a huge job. Oftentimes, your tax professional is so busy trying to keep you in compliance that some of the items, like what we're talking about right now, like do you have an accountable plan, it falls through the cracks because a tax strategist or a tax planner's job is to be forward-thinking at all times and to understand and apply the IRS code, but also to anticipate your future income and expenses in such a way that they're protecting you from overtaxation. And so really, a planner's job is to actively look for ways to mitigate your taxes. I actually had a client say to me, you know, most tax professionals are just historians. And really, as business owners or even as high net worth individuals, we don't want to just be historians. We don't want to just record history and take what comes. Really, by being proactive, we can actually kind of write some of this history, you know, by utilizing things like an accountability plan or a medical reimbursement plan or an educational reimbursement plan used properly for, you know, entrepreneurs. Those can really be active ways that we can mitigate taxes from that standpoint.
Is there any kind of tax strategy, because we all want to pay the least amount of taxes legally that we can, that you think might be a little controversial or something that other CPAs might think is kind of in the gray area for those of us that want to be more aggressive? Can you think of anything like that?
Well,
that might help
us definitely. I can think of lots of things. So one of the things is we always want to make sure that any recommendation we make is seated in code and regulation, okay? And not everything that is going to fit everyone in their particular situation. So tax planning is very individualized, just like financial planning is. But there are different vehicles that an individual can utilize from a tax planning standpoint. So, you know, one of the individual tax planning strategies that high net worth individuals who have corporations could look at is something like a CIC or a captive. So a closely held insurance company might be something that they could actually institute. Now, here's the thing, though. It can be an IRS dirty dozen if you're using it. You know, you cannot use these type of plans just to avoid taxation. That's evasion. A closely held insurance company, I just was having a conversation with someone today, a closely held insurance company is sole purpose is to mitigate liability and to utilize it to mitigate that liability. Now, does it happen to have some tax benefits? Yes, definitely it does, but it has to be used in accordance for what it's intended to do, and that is to mitigate liability first and foremost from an insurance standpoint. And so there's a lot of different vehicles out there that offer, you know, pros and cons. Is that going to fit everyone? No. And if you came to me and told me that you were just going to use it as a tax planning strategy and you didn't worry about insurance liability, it'd be something that I would not recommend or institute, because it's very, you know, and that's gray. That's a gray area that I think a lot of tax professionals, you know, have to make that judgment call about.
And now let's take a moment for a quick commercial break. My friends, when it comes to running your medical practice, you are the boss. And it's tough running those day-to-day operations and making sure there's enough money to pay the bills. And that's why Plastiq can help you with your business and cash flow, making everything run smoothly. And that's because Plastiq, that's Plastiq with a Q, lets you pay virtually any business expense with a credit card, from suppliers to contractors to your commercial lease. And you're still earning cash back. You're earning points, you're earning rewards every time you use Plastiq. Go to plastiq.com/physicians today. And when you sign up and make your first payment up to $1,000, Plastiq will waive the transaction fee. That's PLASTIQ. Again, my friends, PLASTIQ, Plastiq with a Q, .com/physicians. And now, back to the show.
Well, certainly, I mean, doctors, as much as, if not more than many other professionals, have a heck of a lot of liability in what they do. And with tail coverage and all kinds of issues that come up with malpractice policies. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit more about this, because I've never heard of this before. So the closely held insurance company, or CIC, you called it. Is this, how does this work? Tell us more about that.
We could spend 3 hours speaking about this. A closely held insurance company is going to be an insurance company that is actually formed to actually mitigate risk. And so when you actually go through a discovery process to see if this is actually even going to be something that you are going to even qualify for. So there's a very intensive feasibility study that really takes a look at all of the different risks that your specific profession and your specific business actually are coming under. So you mentioned malpractice, and, you know, lawsuits. There could be tax law changes. So there could be, you know, environmental changes if you have your own solo practitioner and you're dealing with medical equipment or, you know, that type of thing. So after going through a feasibility study, an actuary is going to let you know what risks actually exist for your individual business. And then after looking at those risks, how much you can insure against. So they may say your company has $1 million worth of malpractice coverage that's not being covered anyplace else. And so you can buy an insurance plan or through this closely held insurance company to cover that $1 million of risk. So here's the caveat, though. You own that insurance company, okay? You actually own the insurance company, and you are actually transferring the risk from your current business into this insurance company. So it's a way to add an additional layer of asset protection. It's a way, it's an alternative risk transfer. So here's the concept in a nutshell. You identify insurable business and investment risk through an independent feasibility study. If it is a risk that you can insure against, you can establish a captive or a closely held insurance company, which is just a P&C company. It's a property and casualty insurance company that is a C-Corp, files its own U.S. tax return. You as the business owner pay premiums based on the insurance coverage that you want to provide to your company. So you pay in premiums from your operating entity to the closely held insurance company. You deduct those premiums from your operating income because it's expense. And that income then goes into the closely held insurance company. And that's a separate entity. And so what's happening inside that entity, however, is those premiums then are pooled together. Sometimes you're going into a pool of individuals that are part owners of your closely held insurance company. Sometimes you are just having the full chick be your own. And that money, so let's say, for instance, you have a bona fide risk. You've got to have bona fide risk in this. You've got to have bona fide insurance coverage. And let's say your premium every year is $400,000 to cover all of these disparate risks within your company. That $400,000 is a line item expense on your own operating entity. And that $400,000 goes into the chick, and then it can be invested however your closely held insurance company determines is necessary. So that could be a brokerage account. It could be utilized to buy life insurance. But the key component here is that there's bona fide risk sharing. There's bona fide insurance coverage. And really, it's really a kind of a strategy where 80% of all S&P 500 companies actually utilize chicks. And we don't ever know that, you know, because they have to be done very precisely, and there are very specific technical requirements to qualify for the preferential tax treatment. And you don't want the IRS to ever, poke a hole in it. It's actually governed by the IRS code 831B, which provides the favorable tax treatment.
Well, it really reminds me a lot of a foundation in terms of the kind of strategies you can think of for foundations in terms of putting assets and getting a tax deduction for it, or if you have the various kinds of trusts, like an ILIT, irrevocable life insurance trust, where you have to follow very specific rules and instructions to do it. And at the same point, there's a cost to it. So, you know, if someone's just looking to shelter like $20,000, that probably doesn't make sense, because you have to hire an actuary, you have to file another tax return, you know, is something like this. And you probably have to have an actuary look at this every year to reassess the risk, I'm assuming.
Oh, definitely. So, exactly. So you're going to have feasibility studies. You're going to have, you know, this is governed by a specific section of IRS code, so we don't want anything to be technically wrong with that from that standpoint. So really, this is going to be for someone whose company is in the $1 million to, you know, an up dollar range of revenue. And really, you know, you're going to be looking at a premium of $300,000 to $600,000 a year, and you have to be able to do that every single year. So you have to have a business that's growing and sustainable that can actually do this type of strategy. And you have to have risk. Not every business has a lot of risk.
Fascinating. Reminds me a lot of a defined benefit plan in a lot of ways.
Well, so here's think about this for a second though. A qualified business, you know, a defined benefit plan, or even a qualified plan has, you deduct the contribution. In a chick, you deduct the contribution. In a qualified plan, though, there's contribution limits, there's penalty for early withdrawal, there's R&Ds, there's non-discrimination rules, and the proceeds are ordinary income. In a chick, there's deductible contributions, no contribution limit, no penalty for early withdrawal, no R&Ds, no discrimination rules, and the proceeds are capital gains.
So, fascinating.
Yes, it looks, walks, and talks a lot like a qualified plan, but it doesn't have all of the strings attached to it. That's why a lot of clients want to look at this chick, and a lot of tax professionals are going to be like, this is too gray. You know, this is IRS Dirty Dozen. However, if you understand the pros and the cons, and you have that bona fide risk, I mean, this is a risk-sharing model, and you have that bona fide risk, then, you know, it's something to actually take a look at as long as you make sure you have the bona fide risk and you have the bona fide insurance coverage. And there's specialized companies that do this, by the way.
When if you're putting in, which I know there's people that listen to this podcast that are making $800, $900, $1 million a year or more, you know, you really want to take a look at this kind of thing because it might cost you, I don't know, I'm just totally guessing $25,000 a year, something like that? Is that on the high end?
Well, it's gonna, right. Well, and that's, no, I would say it's going to, it, the average that I see is between $18,000 to $20,000 a year to maintain.
Okay. So, and the, you have to set it up and you have some costs of that. But if you're able to make, obviously, $300,000, $400,000 into this plan, you know, that cost can be offset in terms of the long-term projections.
Well, and it's also a line item on your operating entity's profit and loss.
Sure, sure. Fascinating.
So,
I love it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that idea, Shannon. I want to keep on moving on to starting to wrap up the podcast. And I would love to know from you, you know, a lot of physicians, a lot of us that listen to this podcast just haven't had business school or business lessons or, you know, they're learning on the go. They spend all this time in medical training.
Yes.
Four years undergrad, 4 years medical school, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years residency and fellowship. And they don't get taught business stuff. At least most of them don't. And so they turn a podcast like this to figure out business lessons. So I'd love to know from you, what are your top one or two business lessons that you'd like to pass on to us?
Well, I think one of the things that, you know, I've been in business now since 1996, and when I look at business, I always look for a mentor. I mean, I know that has nothing to do with tax strategy. So one of the things that has kind of evolved in my life is that I've realized that I've always had a business mentor or a business coach, and sometimes I'll have more than one coach at a time because sometimes we can't see the forest for the trees. Like I was having a meeting this morning with, and I think I mentioned this, Perry Marshall, and he and I, you know, he's one of my business coaches. And he and I were, I was like, okay, I have this going on. I have this opportunity. And he was like, okay. And he gave me some really good advice. And he said to me, oftentimes when opportunity presents itself, usually the answer needs to be no. Don't lose focus on what your current focus is today. So if I didn't have a business mentor or a business coach, then I wouldn't have the ability to call on somebody who can see things from outside my circumstances. And a mentor is going to be someone, you know, find someone who's already done it. Like, don't reinvent the wheel. You know, find someone who can help you build that practice or someone who is the expert in their field who can you can come alongside and learn from. So I think that's probably the biggest takeaway is being an entrepreneur. Even after all of these years, I still look and seek out individuals who know more than I do and who can give me new insights. And also be willing. I know I was very stubborn in my early years. I was so stubborn I didn't want to take the advice of anyone else because I knew how to do it. And as I've gotten older, I realize I don't know everything. Like, I'm part of a mastermind group, and we meet 3 times a year, and these are big boys. Like, I'm like the lowliest entrepreneur in this room. I'm talking like, you know, these people have PhDs from Stanford, and they're making $150 million a year, and or they just sold their business to PayPal for, you know, $1 billion. And I'm in this room networking with these entrepreneurs, and we're all in different industries, but we do it 3 times a year just because we need to be spurred on to be better than what we already are. So get a mentor, get a business coach, and get in community with other business owners because that's where you're really going to really find growth and traction. So that's my kind of my takeaway there.
I love it. I love it. And as you're around these people that are doing amazing things and have done amazing things, one of the things I talk about a lot on this podcast is there's two different kinds of mentalities when it comes to saving. And one is piles of cash, where you're like Uncle Scrooge swimming around in the money bin, because you're going to withdraw a certain amount from it every single year, and you're relying on that pile of cash to slowly dwindle down, or maybe even grow a little bit. And then you have the other mentality, which is rivers of income, where you have own real estate or own businesses or what have you that feed you income. From these ultra-successful people that you're around, which or both, do they follow both of these strategies?
No.
What would you say?
We all follow the multiple streams of income. Every single one of us, when we're sitting in that room, we're all doing multiple things. I mean, like I say, I'm a serial entrepreneur. I'm always looking for opportunities. People come to me all the time pitching me new ideas, pitching me new companies. And Richard Koch is, if you've ever written 80/20 Manager or any of Richard's books, you know, Richard has some really good advice about multiple streams of income. However, he says, you know, someone might pitch me 15 deals a year or 15 opportunities. I only do one deal every 15 months. So when you're looking for a multiple stream of income, look for something that's going to resonate with you, that's not going to feel like work, because if it feels like work, you're not going to want to continue to do it, and money's not worth the drain of energy and things of that nature. But definitely look for those multiple streams of income. And that's where there's a difference between having cash flow and building equity. There's a huge difference. And really what you described are two different paradigms. But the ultra wealthy and entrepreneurs that I associate with, we all have multiple streams of income.
Fascinating. Okay, well, great feedback, Shannon. And where can people find you? I know you had something that you wanted to offer up to us.
Yeah, definitely. So you can find me at advancedaccounting.com, or you can Google, you know, Shannon Stewart. You'll be able to find me there. One of the things I always do in my podcast is I offer a half-hour tax consultation. So if you have questions specifically about your situation, or does everything look right even on your tax return? I would be more than happy to take a half hour and to speak with you about your particular situation, any kind of specific strategies you can do, because it's so individualized. And you can go to my website and actually sign up for a consultation. And also there's an ebook on there about the 10 biggest mistakes that we make in taxation. So go ahead, go that way, download the free ebook, sign up for a consultation, and I would love to connect.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Shannon. Really appreciate you being on board.
Thank you so much.
All right, my friends. Well, there you have it. Another episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. Hope you love Shannon's strategies. And again, you can check her out at advancedaccounting.com. For the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, this is Dave Denniston. And remember, my friends, remember to slash your debt, slash your taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle.
All right, my friends, well, that wraps up the episode for today. Hope you picked up some great nuggets in our episode. And I want to make sure just to give a huge shout out to our sponsor, Plastic, Plastic with a Q. Make sure to check them out so they can help make your practice get to the next level, to keep your business running smoothly. Check them out at plastiq.com/physicians. Again, visit them right now, Plastic, plastiq.com/physicians.